Good morning, everybody, and welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're joined this morning by Kevin Davis, Baltimore City's police commissioner. So please do join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. But do join us, 410-319-8888. Your opportunity to talk with the commissioner about all your thoughts and ideas that you'd like him to answer and your questions about your community and more, 410-319-8888. And Kevin Davis, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Hi. Thank you, Mark. I've really been looking forward to this invitation.
Me too. It's good to see you. Good to see you, too. Good seeing you last night at Bobby Marvin Holmes' opening of his film.
Yeah, I thought that was great. And I was joined last night by director T.J. Smith, who leads our media relations team. And it was wonderful. And what a time to do that, to show that film. And this is such an important time for the whole city.
No, it is. I mean, we're sitting here. Just quickly, your reflections before we get into some really specific topics. Tomorrow will be a year. Since Freddie Gray passed away after being arrested by Baltimore City Police. So what are your thoughts about all that's surrounding all of this? I know you can't talk about the cases.
It's April 19th is an important day for the city, for the police department, and really for the law enforcement profession. So as I look at what's changed since 2015, and a lot has changed, and we'll really know with a greater degree of certainty, let's say 5 years from now, what 2015 has meant to our society and to American policing, because I think we're in the midst of a sea change. But to me, it's convinced me beyond an absolute shadow of a doubt that by the time a person or a family or a neighborhood has encounters with the police, there's so many other failures that have normally taken place before that. So whether it's schools or housing, whether it's health, whether it's transportation, whether it's other failures in society or in government, typically let a person or a family down, and then crisis visits that person or family, and a lot of people in crisis, turn to things that ultimately lead them to an encounter with the police. So I think if 2015 means anything, it can't just be all about the police. It's got to be bigger and better than that.
So when you use the term sea change, you think that we're in a sea change about policing in America. So what does that mean for you?
Well, one-dimensional policing doesn't work. Zero tolerance policing doesn't work. The war on drugs failed. So I was raised in this culture. That really started with the introduction of crack cocaine to big cities across America.
You became a police officer in the 80s.
92. So, late 80s, early 90s. And, I retired from Prince George's County. So Prince George's has similar crime challenges as the city does, particularly back then. So we're in the midst of this time where violence just skyrocketed throughout the country. And a response from law enforcement was, well, let's engage in zero tolerance policing. Let's make more discretionary arrests. And by discretionary arrests, I'm not talking about murder, rape, robbery, theft, and burglary. I'm talking about things like disorderly conduct, failure to obey a lawful order, loitering, trespassing, all those things. And those are the type of arrests that went up. And American policing back then thought that if those smaller things could be attacked, then that would ultimately impact the greater violent crime picture. Well, it didn't. And really what it did is it drove a wedge between poor communities and police departments, not only here in Baltimore, but elsewhere across our country.
So, and folks, join us here, 410-319-8888, to have your thoughts heard by the commissioner and also to have your questions answered, 410-319-8888. And we have one question that came in by text, but I'll come to that question in just a moment because it's an important issue. Like what came out of Annapolis, we'll talk about that in a moment. Thanks for that text. 410-319-8888 is the number here. But let me begin this way, because what you just said. I wanted to bear with me here. I'm just pulling up my notes here to make sure I say this correctly. So one of the things. Before we get into all the heartbeat of Freddie Gray and what came out of Annapolis, which I really want to get to, and the state of policing, and the No Boundaries Coalition report that came out, which I thought was a pretty powerful piece of this community's road. But you talked about what the war on drugs did. So from what I've been reading, there are 35,000 people in Baltimore who have warrants out for them. of people who have warrants out for them for misdemeanors, for nonviolent misdemeanors, possession of drugs, disorderly conduct, trespass, shoplifting, disorderly, simple drug possession. And they amount in some ways, to someone told me this morning, to 90%, almost 90% or more of all arrests. Only 7% of most arrests end up in indictments. And there's a whole push now to get rid of these warrants, to so people can go home and come back to court and deal with what they have. It's called the warrant forgiveness idea.
Right,
for
all,
that's 35,000 warrants. That's a lot of people in the city.
Right. Very, very familiar with that.
So what is your position on warrant forgiveness for these nonviolent offenders?
Not opposed to it, but I do think we have to put a team together in a room around a table from the judiciary, from the state's attorney's office, from the public defender's office, and from the police department, and from parole and probation. So when we talk about warrant forgiveness, I think warrant forgiveness gets a lot of head nods. Yeah, that makes sense. But what does it mean in terms of the nuts and bolts of it all? So,
What do you mean by that? I mean, what does it mean? What are the complexities you see that can't let it just happen?
To appear in court, for instance, if we forgive that failure to appear in court warrant, does it mean that that person charged with a crime and the matter is still pending will ever be compelled to appear for that crime that was charged? So, I just think that the devil's in the details with warrant forgiveness, but I do want your listeners to hear me say that I'm absolutely looking forward to being part of that conversation to get to a point that's reasonable and acceptable to everyone. And I think the people that we have to keep in mind first and foremost are the people who are walking around with their head on a swivel because they don't want to be caught with a minor warrant because they've got a job to go to. They've got a family to bring a paycheck home to. So I get that. And I think I'm as progressive as you'll find, Mark, when it comes to police chiefs in America in terms of finding a different way forward. But, you know, in terms of the the other matter that was heard in Annapolis.
The civilians on the hearing boards?
No, we can talk about that, too.
We're going to get to that. Yeah.
But I think if you're charged with a crime and that crime is or that case is dismissed it's otherwise put on a stat docket, I do think it should be an automatic expungement. So that's the word I was grappling to find. And I don't know why. But I don't think you should necessarily have to apply to have your dismissed case expunged, because that just assumes that you know how to engage in that process.
Right.
So I'm for automatic expungements. So I really just think that whatever we can do to create a healthier environment between the community, the entire community, and the police department is probably a good thing. So, but I do think, too, Mark, that we got to put the right people around the table to talk about it.
So we're going to open the phone to answer this question here, right? Because it leads to something else you said earlier, which had to do with the failure of the war on drugs. And so when all these people are being arrested for these misdemeanors, nonviolent misdemeanors especially, when the state's attorney went through these and found these 35,000 cases, she took out things like domestic abuse and all those things were not in this program or in this proposal. But does this say that maybe something's wrong with the way we arrest people, that we're arresting people for possession of drugs, disorderly conduct, getting into some kind of minor confrontation on the street, arguing with a police officer about something, that there may be some other ways for us to deal with this that are not arrests?
Right.
I mean, because this is the point where things explode.
Right. So that's why it's so important. And we're on the cutting edge of it with de-escalation training on our police department. So, you know, before a interaction between a police officer and a citizen leads to a discretionary arrest.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not talking about giving anyone who's a murderer or a rapist or a robber or a burglar
a free pass.
So let's go to the other category. It's the interactions that typically happen during a response to a call for service or during a police citizen encounter, and that interaction goes south. And it goes south because one or both involved parties are uncivil to each other. So that's why I'm really looking forward to, Mark, the introduction of body-worn cameras to Baltimore. Our first supply of 500 arrives in May. We know based on our pilot program that the 155 cops who wore the body cameras to a person said that it lowered the temperature of police-citizen interactions. And if it keeps us on our P's and Q's, and it also serves as a reminder to everyone there at the moment of that encounter that it's being recorded, you know, I think that's a good thing. I think, you know, far too often, and this will probably always be the case in our profession, we deal with people on their worst day. And whenever we have an interaction with somebody, it's not always a pleasant interaction. It may be in response to a call for service. It may be in response to a crime scene search. But the interaction already starts up here. It already starts at a high level. So how do we diffuse? How do we interact with each other civilly? And the cameras are going to help.
So this may be this question I've asked some of the mayoral candidates. I'll ask you as well. Then Mimi, you're the first caller up. We're going to Bill, and we're going to read this text from Dee and go to Donna as well. So there have been some people would argue and say, well, maybe the police don't have to respond to all calls. But this is what I mean by that. You have things like safe streets. There was a time before you came to Baltimore in the 90s, which was a big debate because they hired actually the city contracted with the Fruit of Islam, the Nation of Islam, to patrol housing projects, keep down the violence, help with disputes, and calm things down and help people figure out the problems and get people to find other solutions other than getting arrested. And then other people would also talked about the idea that there's restorative justice rather than just arrests and how communities can resolve this. Is there something a police department can do to say that join a conversation saying maybe officers aren't needed in every dispute that exists and we can find alternative systems that help grow communities and lessen arrests?
Right. Well, I think, Mark, here's what's happened in America. And again, Baltimore is not unique. A person or a family or a neighborhood in crisis calls the police to solve their crisis. But their crisis very often has nothing to do with a violation of the law. We get called to handle a family scenario or a neighborhood concern that resulted because of other failures, again, in government and society. So I'm an advocate of organizations like Safe Streets and Guardian Angels and, you know, any way we can do it that can mediate or prevent an unnecessary interaction that may lead to an arrest is something I'm willing to explore. Again, the devil's always in the details, but, you know, where we are in society. And again, you know, I've been a Marylander my whole life, and this is my third police department in Maryland, and I'm just very, you know, humbled to be here and serve in Baltimore. But the mindset of the society is, particularly if it's not between Monday and Friday, 9 to 5, the only government entity that typically exists to respond to and handle a crisis is the police department. So we get called to that crisis. And I've been really successful. We've been successful working with Dr. Nguyen in the health department. She's brilliant, by the way. She's absolutely an all-star, you know, MVP for this city.
I agree.
So how do we involve other aspects of government and society to handle people and families in crisis so the cops don't have to be that final authority? Because, you know, I think we all realize now that our only tool cannot be a set of handcuffs. We can't arrest our way out of any challenge.
So that raises other issues, but let me open the phones first and also get these other emails coming in. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Mimi, on line one, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Good morning, Mimi.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I certainly feel for the commissioner because it's very difficult to be in any of the institutions in this world today that are really, I think, in my opinion, are supporting the corporations that obviously are not there for the people. So it's a very difficult situation to be in. And I don't know if you all listen to Democracy Now. Did you listen to it, Mark?
I listen to it often, but now I'm usually prepping in the morning for my show.
I'm saying today.
No.
The slave labor around the world, and Indonesia specifically they talk about, is providing the fish industry in this country. Slave labor is providing everything in this country. Not everything, but in all the things that are manufactured, fish and so on, because it's set up not for the people. That's just where I'm coming from, and I, you know, I see the research is proving that. In this particular instance, the commissioner, you were saying that, you know, the police are responding in situations, you know, when it's already a neighborhood in crisis. But what about the people who are walking on the streets or homeless people, people who have been it's not because somebody has called in and seen some kind of activity that could warrant arrests, but because people are being targeted to be, I don't know, suppressed. I don't know. I don't want to put any, you know, emotional thing into it, but that's where all the, you know, the cases that are being brought about out into the open in this country of people of color, or sometimes just poor people who are not of color, are abused. And they get killed, you know, with 60 bullets or 40 bullets. So it's not really just because some neighborhood, you know, is in crisis and somebody is acting out and then they have to be suppressed.
Okay.
Anyhow, one other thing. I mean, and I feel for you because it's not a police department can't, you know, solve this. But yesterday, a friend of mine's son was coming home from some, I don't really remember the details because I'm 80 years old. And I do forget. And he was, somebody called and said that there was a break-in. Well, it was his own home. He went around back because he couldn't get in the front. He was arrested. His son was dragged out. A 12-year-old was dragged out of the house. This is yesterday. Barefoot. They let him go back inside. They said they're just taking the grown-up, her son, to the precinct, but he ended up in central booking, and she kept saying, this is his house. This is my friend, she called and said, this is his house. That didn't matter. And this, in Harvard, I think it was Gates, it was some well-known Harvard professor. Yeah,
maybe we really have a lot of callers, so I can't, I just need to get a question so I can let the commission respond. I'm sorry. Mimi, you still there? Did we lose Mimi?
It's not a police problem. Thank you. Sorry I took up so much time.
No, it's okay, Mimi. It's okay. I mean, I think that what Mimi is describing is not something that is odd. There was also, or strange, there was a video that was put out by Fox TV the other day about a young man who's saying, this is my house. There was no warrant. Police dragged him, arrested him, tackled by an officer who just drove up and tackled him and then arrested him, and then was not charged. And this happens all the time. I was going to raise the No Boundaries Coalition report where they interviewed 500 people in Westside communities. When you look at the details of that report, the most shocking thing is not these videos of things like Freddie Gray to me, which is I thought was horrendous, but that the fact that almost everybody to a person spoke about the physical but verbal abuse that they suffer at the hands of police every day. So, I mean – These are the real issues. This is the heart of it.
Right.
What Mimi's
right.
saying and what happened to that young man in the Fox TV piece, I mean, this to me is at the heart of what has to change.
Right. And I think we're all too quick to talk about training and accountability. And training and accountability are absolutely key. But before you get to training and accountability, it's the selection process for not only our police department, but for the 18,000 police departments in our country that employ 900,000 cops in America. So who are we hiring, I guess is what I'm saying, Mark, and what type of selection process do we need to change to ensure that we hire people with a mindset to serve? Because before we address behaviors, I think we overlook the necessity to really examine someone's mindset. So do we have young people who want to be police officers in our city or our country who have a mindset to serve, or do they have a mindset to do something else, to oppress? Are we hiring people who either were bullies themselves or were bullied by bullies? I mean, there's so much more that has to go into the psychological examination of police applicants because our profession, Mark, is so unique. We're the only profession in the world, or at least in the country, that can take a life when legally justified to do so. And we're the only profession that can take someone's freedom away by charging him or her charging a person with crime. So we have awesome responsibilities that no other profession has, but our selection process has been relatively unchanged throughout the year. So I'm a big advocate for more enhanced training, particularly de-escalation training and accountability. The buck stops with me, and I would like to talk about the Annapolis legislation. But we need to do something bigger and better with really getting into the minds and then the hearts, if there is such a thing, of people who want to do this job. Because I don't want to hire warriors; I want to hire guardians.
That's a big difference. I mean, I think that we have a bunch of tweets came in. I mean, just to pursue this. I mean, Jackie Rabars, who's been on the show many times, tweeted in, our client got, and she works with women who, I don't know if you know Jackie's work, but Jackie is one of the most profound organizers and people in the city who works with women who have been addicted, women who are in the sex trade, and just incredible work. She writes in, our client got a citation for open container, quote unquote, then when she didn't show in court, was jailed on a warrant for 10 days. And that was part of that warrant forgiveness thing we were talking about earlier that I think is a huge piece in this.
But remember, Mark, you know, what's tougher, in at least in Maryland, it's more challenging to change an existing law than it is to enact a new law. So, and I think if you talk to state delegates and state senators, they probably agree with me. There's a lot of laws that are on the books that need to be amended. They need to be changed, but it's tougher to sometimes change a law, particularly laws that don't serve the interests of society. It's just tough to change those laws. And police officers are tasked with enforcing laws that are passed by our elected leaders. So it's a bigger conversation than just the police.
No, there's no question. But I mean, about Jackie retweeted again, and then we'll get together tweets. It says, stop talking about stop and frisk, or stop and frisky if you're a woman, as if this is a thing of the past. I guess people are feeling like they are people are feeling that they're A, targeted because they're black.
Right.
B, they're targeted because that in poor communities, and that you just that if you're just walking down the street, boom, you're stopped for whatever reason. I mean, and so how do you end that behavior? I mean, people call it systemic racism inside the police department and inside of our systems, period, or that black folks are seen as the target, that you're that you know, this, to a person, I may reiterate this enough in this program and in life, have said, I don't know of a person, especially a black person in this community, in life that I know, that have not said, I was stopped, taken out of my car, frisked, or a white person that I know can say, like me, when I was stopped for a taillight, all the police officer said to me was, you look just like my uncle, and let me go.
Right.
But if I was black, I wouldn't be his uncle.
Right.
And I wouldn't let me go. He probably would escalate. So how do you change that? I mean, how does that end?
It's a leadership responsibility in this profession. So when I spoke earlier about one-dimensional policing, we've raised an entire generation or two or three of police officers in America who are from a warrior generation. So particularly post-crack cocaine epidemic. So if there's a war on drugs – and if there's zero tolerance policing that were acceptable, and I use were because it's past tense, then I am my worth as a police officer or a detective surrounds how many arrests I make, how many citations I issue, how many stop and frisk encounters I have. And based on that, you know, that red meat that I put on the table, I'm transferred to a specialty unit or I'm promoted within my organization. One thing that we started doing a couple months ago in Baltimore, and it's relatively unique in our profession, is every week we recognize a police officer for his or her guardian type performance. So it's not the traditional arrests. It's what have you done outside of what has traditionally been measured, because what gets measured in our profession gets rewarded, and what gets rewarded in our profession gets repeated. So we've measured for so long in our profession number of arrests, number of citations, number of stop and frisk encounters, and then the cream of that crop rises. They get rewarded. They get promoted. And the same behavior gets repeated. So I don't talk about arrests at all. In our daily concept meeting, I don't talk about numbers at all. The only numbers I'm interested in are numbers of victims of crime. So it's just changing the conversation within our own culture to stop talking about these artificial things like arrests, citations, and non-consensual encounters, and start measuring the effectiveness of police officers differently, because we will build, and we are building, a generation of guardians, but we still have that warrior type mentality.
So I'm going to go to quick break, come right back. Bill, you're on the air. Angie, you're on the air. Bill, you'll be on the air a day. We're going to read your tweet as soon as we come back. 410-319-8888. Stay with us. A lot of tweets coming in. We'll get to those as well. The show is yours now when we come back. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here with our new police commissioner. Well, he's not soon anymore, Kevin Davis. I keep calling him Keith, but his name is Kevin. Sorry, Kevin.
Close enough.
410-319-8888 is the number. But here's the tweet that came in. Here's my question. It says, will you consent, you being Kevin Davis, will you consent to selecting a process of selecting civilians on police trial boards in which you share power with the community in selecting them?
Well, you may or may not know this, Mark, but I've been as outspoken, if not more outspoken, than any police chief in our state about the necessity to reform some aspects of the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. And that's a law that's been around since 1975. Probably any law that's been around since 1975 needs a degree of tinkering and changing. And so LAOBR is one of those. And one of the things that that comes with this position as police commissioner or police chief anywhere else in Maryland is the accountability stops with me. I'm held accountable for discipline within my organization, fair, impartial. Right now, I don't have complete control over the disciplinary system within my own organization. And every police chief in Maryland can say the same thing. So I want the responsibility and I want the accountability. And what I'm saying to people is give it to me. Give it to me and then judge me on how I perform. So that's why I'm pretty adamant at being given the authority to select and train the citizens who may be chosen to serve on our administrative hearing boards. So there's a degree of trust I get that comes with that statement. I mean, you know, what I'm asking people to do is trust me to pick the right people to serve on this board. And I will pick the right people. And there is a significant degree of training that's associated with that. Ultimately, what has come out of Annapolis is not as neat and tidy as people think it is. The selection of civilians to serve on administrative hearing boards is subject to collective bargaining. So it's not an automatic. It's subject to collective bargaining with each individual police department throughout the state. So it's not a snap of the fingers fix. But if I get to the point where I can select citizens to serve on these trial boards, I do, Mark, want to be given the authority to select those myself.
I think that Devon's question was pushed a tad further. He was saying, do you support the idea of sharing power with the community and selecting people who actually – civilians who have power on these police review boards?
Well, the community does have power with me. So I would speak to people and I'd speak to organizations and I'd take input from anywhere it exists to help me make those – right selections. But again, I've got to be given the authority to make those selections if folks are going to hold me responsible for discipline within my own organization. So would I talk to people and would I be open-minded and collaborative about people that I would consider to serve in that capacity? I absolutely would.
So how does that process start? I mean, because now this legislation has opened up open the door to a renegotiating things with the FOP when contracts come up, A, right, and right. B, the community is saying, we don't want the commissioner just to decide by himself. We want to be part of deciding who sits on this board right. that has real power to determine what happens with these officers who have been accused of some malfeasance in the job.
Right, right. And what I'm saying, you're right, it is a couple steps that need to take place before that conversation really takes place. It is subject to collective bargaining. You know, what came out of Annapolis was not a panacea. There was no silver bullet that came out of Annapolis this session. You know, maybe it will be refined in future sessions and years forward. But right now, what we have is a collective bargaining scenario that will determine whether or not I'll even be permitted to select citizens to serve on the board. And what I'm promising people is that I will be as open-minded and inclusive as possible, but I want that decision, I want that responsibility, I want that accountability, and I want to make that choice myself as the leader of this organization.
So let me go back to the phones here and come back to the tweets. 410-319-8888. And who's been, Bill, you've been holding on the longest. You're on the air. Welcome. Line two.
Yes, first of all, just let me say hello. And I just want to give two obvious facts that I would like to get answered. One is that you can say like 9 times out of 10, you know, in a black community, if police is called and black guy got a knife, then it's likely that he'll be killed. You take the same scenario in a white community, then it's the opposite. 1 out of 10, and a white guy is going to be killed. So the black guy get killed 9 times, the white guy 1 time. The other thing is that, you know, it's true that white people use more drugs and have access to more drugs, yet black people is locked up 50 times more than white people on the drug situation. How would you change that?
Well, one thing I have changed is I brought in a team to head up the Office of Professional Responsibility on the Baltimore Police Department. So, most of them are attorneys. They all have significant experience in this profession, both as internal affairs commanders and prosecutors. So we have fundamentally changed the way our disciplinary system is structured, because one of the most important things we do as a police department is investigate police deadly force scenarios. And, you know, that goes right to the trust that we have with our community and the structure that we have in place now on the Baltimore Police Department to investigate police-involved shootings and in-custody deaths is as sophisticated as any police department in the country. And, you know, Mark, last night at the film debut screening, I'm not sure which one it is.
Screening? It would be a debut screening,
debut
I think.
Debut screening.
Right.
It was interesting to hear some of the loved ones.
Live Young Blood, Bobby Marvin Holmes' second film.
And it was wonderful. Right. And some folks talked to and shared their just tragic experiences and their grief that's associated with losing a loved one to a deadly police encounter. And what I thought was unique about that, even though most of the film seemed to be Baltimore-centric, a couple of those scenarios spoke about deadly police encounters elsewhere in Maryland. There was one mother who spoke about losing her son in Prince George's County, and then there was another deadly police-involved encounter that occurred in Baltimore County. So I mention that because it's our profession that fundamentally needs to change the way that we do certain things. And it's not unique to Baltimore. We're going to get it right in Baltimore, and we're going to lead the way in Baltimore. And I'm comfortable with the changes that I've made within our disciplinary system that we're going to be on the front edge of that effort.
So I'm going to go right up to the phone here. I'm just very curious, because you keep saying it's going to change in Baltimore,
and it is changing. It's not all future tense.
I believe that your sincerity with all that. Yeah. So you've been a police officer for 25 years, right?
Yeah.
So what is it that's changed in you? Because when you became a police officer, it was still the middle of the war on drugs. We've now seen from President Nixon statements and coming out of the Reagan administration that these were targeted at black folks,
right?
Very specifically,
right?
Which is why we had this mass incarceration of black people in this country, people of color in general. So what has it changed in you? I mean,
So, Mark, I'm 47 now, right?
Right.
I started this career, this journey, when I was 22. I am a far different person than I was at 22, and thank God for that. We all are, you know. Thank God for that. So, as I looked at my own profession, and as I experienced things throughout my career, and I did all those high-profile assignments. I was a patrol officer. I was a drug detective. I was on the SWAT team. I was the chief of detectives. I've had all those experiences within our profession that have exposed me to all that is right and all that is wrong. And I think fundamentally the most important thing that has changed is that there's the focus cannot just be on, you know, what can you put on the table in response to a crime trend or pattern or a spike in violence that's beyond arrests. So that was the way. That was the way in the 90s. And that's where you got police departments and political leaders who just bought into this zero tolerance policing because there was such a hyper focus on the homicide rate in particular. And there needs to be, because those are people who've lost their lives. But I think what we've realized, what I've realized, growing throughout my lifetime and my career, is that we have a very sincere responsibility to get this right. And the way that our profession has done this, late 80s, early 90s forward, hasn't been a way that served the best interests of our relationship with the community. I hear everywhere I go in Baltimore, you know, bring back more foot patrol officers. But really what folks are saying is bring back more respectful interactions between the cops and the citizens. So that you know, we've developed an academic foot patrol curriculum, first department in the country, where we teach 40 hours of community foot patrol in our police academy. All of our cops are going through it during in-service training this year. Every police officer in Baltimore this year is going through the Outward Bound experience, where 6,000 young people from throughout the city will have one-on-one encounters at Leakin Park or the YMCA with a police officer. So we're doing things differently. And I don't know, Mark, that we'd be doing things as differently as we're doing them or as quickly as we've been doing them if not for the events of last year.
We're here with Kevin Davis, who is Baltimore City Police Commissioner, taking your calls at 410-319-8888. We have a follow-up from a question that Devon sent in earlier. I'll read that in just a moment. We have a tweet here at Mark Steiner from Sharagarian Bay, who says, I agree some employers exclude applicants just because of arrest, not convictions.
Yeah.
Elect Ryan Dorsey has written in, he's running for city council, that for the recruiting video for the Baltimore Police Department website makes a warrior case based on the soundtrack alone.
Well, that'll be the first thing I do is go back and listen to that when I'm done with your show, Mark. But you know, that, again, we want to hire guardians. We want to hire people with a mindset to serve because we jump to behavior so quickly. But I want to change the mindset. If you change the mindset, you change behaviors for good.
So let me come back to the other questions from Devon, but let's go to the phones. We've lost a bunch of our callers. I apologize. We can come right to your calls at 410-319-8888. Don't be impatient. A lot of folks are trying to get in. Do call back. Angie in Woodlawn, you're on the air.
Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hello, Commissioner Davis.
Good morning, Angie.
Okay. My question is, and I'll hang up the answer, I'm wondering if in the screening process, would it be possible to, I know you do a polygraph test, would it be possible to ask applicants their views on how they would treat the community? And if they believe in treating everybody equal, and if they fail that, then they should not be able to be police officers. Is that possible?
So that's where we need to enhance our psychological screening. And it needs to be more robust. We need to spend more time and attention to that psychological screening component. Right now, all of our police applicants go through a psychological evaluation, but I do not think it is robust enough. And when you get down to a person's upbringing, for instance, and I'll say this, it's really important to identify people who have experienced different cultures outside of their own. So that's got to be a stronger focus, and it is a stronger focus in Baltimore. While we have a diverse police department, we have racial diversity on the Baltimore Police Department. We need to dramatically improve on the number of local people, particularly African-American young men who choose to join our police department. We're not doing as well there as we need to be doing, and that's one strong focus that I have going forward. And then on top of that, another subcategory is we need to encourage more cops in Baltimore to live in the city. And we're doing some tangible things to achieve that. Like we do this thing, Mark, called Pizza in the Precinct. We bring the whole academy class out to neighborhoods throughout the city, at night, and they're wearing plain clothes, and they get a little walk and talk with a community leader throughout the community, and then they end up at a local pizza place. So we're trying to encourage as much as we can our young police officers to establish roots in the city because it's important for people to see them.
And recruiting officers maybe from the city.
Well, more cops from the city. I think just that experience growing up here and your familiarity with, diverse neighborhoods and communities. We've enhanced our cultural sensitivity training. We're doing the speaker series called A History of Baltimore this year, and it's aimed at enhancing cultural sensitivity. The city's just a microcosm of America. Depending on where you go, what neighborhood you're in, you're experiencing something that's unique. And we need to do a better job of hiring cops with a degree of those experiences. And then once we hire them, we need to expose them in a training environment to the different cultures that they're going to encounter. It should not be an encounter for the very first time with someone who you've never dealt with or a culture you've never experienced at a time of crisis. We need to do better with training and selection.
So let me get back to these things. So we're going to read this. William, we're going to come to you. Give 2 seconds. We're going to come right to you in just a minute. I'm going to read this tweet coming in. Trump is a Trump from Thurston, D.C., at Commissioner Davis. Just words forgotten by next session. Actions speak louder than words with black. Actions speak louder than selfies with black folk. And Davon followed up with, yes.
Yeah, and Mark, I'm familiar with that person. He has a very active profile on Twitter. My actions throughout my career have spoken louder than my words. I've served in 3 different jurisdictions. I've had an opportunity to serve in leadership capacities for police departments that have been in a degree of crisis, and I've always been able to emerge with a stronger relationship with the community. So, judge me by my actions. Certainly words are important. I think the community needs to hear how I feel about things. They need to be able to say, he has articulated a vision and a way forward. So I think while actions ultimately rule the day, I think what I have to say about certain matters and certain topics is also important.
As a follow-up to the earlier question from Davon, ask him if he would support an effort locally to take the composition of the trial board off the table for collective bargaining.
I'm not sure I understand that question. So that...
Saying that it's not something to be negotiated. We're going to have a trial board, and we're going to run it in the city, and you're going to be the head of it, and we're going to have civilian people on it.
Yeah, there's a law called the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. It's still an existing law in Maryland, and I can't overrule the state law. So again, what happens during session with our delegates and our senators, and I'll say this for the Baltimore delegation, our state delegates and state senators in Baltimore were really on the front edge of this issue. I think the challenge has been with LEOBR, with other jurisdictions throughout the state feeling the same way. So Baltimore knows where Baltimore needs to go, and I'm looking forward to being part of that progress.
Let me go back to the phones, 410-319-8888. William in West Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning to you, Mr. Stein and Ms. Commissioner.
Good morning, William.
Yes, have you considered... You spoke of sensitivity, cultural sensitivity, and diversity. Have you ever considered do some cross-training, say, with some of the policemen from Baltimore, say, in London, where the policemen don't actually carry guns, so they have to know the personality of people, they have to know how to... So they don't get that sense that I have power, I can kill you at any moment, that kind of thing. So they're more one-to-one,
Well, that's a great question. I recently sent to Scotland... The commander of our Western District, Major Cherie Briscoe, traveled with the Police Executive Research Forum, and PERF is one of the American policing think tanks. And Major Briscoe, our Western District commander, traveled with a group to Scotland to examine their use of force training. And when she came back, and she was really excited to tell me about all the things that Scotland does regarding use of force, regarding their encounters with mentally ill people or developmentally disabled people. And cops now, more than ever, Mark, encounter mentally ill and developmentally disabled folks more than ever. But one thing that struck the commander of our Western District and that strikes me and is probably no surprise to anyone on this program this morning is that guns don't exist elsewhere like they exist in America. So I'm not just talking about cops having guns or not having guns. I'm talking about society. So when we looked at some of the de-escalation training that existed in Scotland, a lot of that surrounded the sheer fact that folks out there who their police department engages with rarely, if ever, are armed with a firearm. So I think, one of the, perhaps, curses of our nation is that this proliferation and just unfettered access and to firearms in our country is something that is an issue for local law enforcement. It impacts daily violence in our country. I'm not sure it's spoken about at the national level to the degree that I personally wish it was spoken about. but it's a problem. And in Maryland, our gun arrests in Baltimore City are up 53% this year.
I saw that.
53%. And I spent some time in Annapolis unsuccessfully, and I hope to be back next year, trying to convince our lawmakers that a decision someone makes to wear, carry, or transport, to illegally wear, carry, or transport a gun in Maryland needs to be a felony. It's a misdemeanor in our state. It's a felony in D.C. It's a felony in New York. It's a felony elsewhere. And it needs to be a felony here, and there needs to be greater consequences to a person's decision to arm himself with a gun. Folks on the right and the left didn't like my support of that for various reasons, but it's really a conversation that at least it's off the ground, and I look forward to being back in Annapolis next year.
Speaking of Annapolis, Lawrence Brown tweeted in, so is he going to go to Annapolis and fight for it, which is because he's talking about the changes in the LOBR to allow that. The police civilian review boards and civilians on task forces on the hearing boards actually take place.
Yeah, the Maryland Chiefs Association was very active in several amendments that were suggested to reform LEOBR. Now, a year ago, there was nothing from Maryland Chiefs, nothing at all, put forward to amend or change the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. This year, this session, the Maryland Chiefs and Sheriffs Association authored a letter that was sent to President Miller and Speaker Bush recommending changes to that legislation. Again, that's progress. That shows leadership, and I was part of that very small vocal group of Maryland chiefs who went to lawmakers. I had one-on-one conversations with many lawmakers advocating changes that I wanted to see with that law. Hopefully we'll be back next year to make some of those changes.
We're here with Kim Davis. Try to get to the call. Excuse me. 410-319-8888. Get to these calls coming in. But let me ask another question before we run out of time. Something I did want to ask you about, which was the report on tasers was in some ways pretty damning about our police department here and the use of tasers and how they were disproportionately used in black communities. And that 90% of those shocked were 730 incidents over 3 years were black residents, and that the overuse of it, again, you know, we lauded these kind of tasers as a way of stopping people from getting shot, but it doesn't seem to be answering the question either.
Right. So I wrote a letter to the editor in The Sun that was published over the weekend speaking specifically about tasers, and I really think that Mark Puente did a great job with that series. So I was appointed by the mayor back on July the 8th. By mid-February, I changed our taser policy. I'm sorry, by mid-August, a month later. Appointed in July, and by mid-August, just a month later, I changed our taser policy because the standard that was in policy for a Baltimore police officer to use a taser was when it was reasonable and necessary. Now, reasonable and necessary is open to too much interpretation or misinterpretation. So I changed that policy. I changed it last August to reflect that tasers can only be used when someone is actively aggressive toward a police officer. So an actively aggressive is specifically defined. And I'm going to further change that policy as a result of a recent court decision, and that additional refined policy will take place sometime this summer. But now, and it didn't happen in the past, every taser use is downloaded. Every police officer in Baltimore who uses a taser has to go to the police academy and document the taser usage. The instrument itself captures the taser usage and how long the taser was deployed, how many uses. So we're at a much, much better place now than we were just a year ago. And by the time we refine this policy again, we'll be exactly where we need to be. I think it's a necessary tool. I think it cuts down on deadly force scenarios. I think it cuts down on blunt force trauma injuries to prisoners and injuries to police officers. But it's something that has to be used responsibly. And again, it was one of the first policies that I changed when I was appointed police commissioner.
So analysis tweets in, Baltimore Police Chief Kevin Davis, must read ACT, R.E., Michelle Alexander's, Michelle Alexander, the new Jim Crow, and Joe Hanhari's Chasing the Scream. I think we're saying that these two books, and we actually interviewed both authors, are very powerful works on the history of our drug war and on this mass incarceration and how to change things. Are you familiar with both?
I have not read both, but I'm or either, and I'll put that on my reading list, my spring-summer reading list.
But they actually might be interesting people for the city police itself to kind of...
Absolutely. And this history of Baltimore cultural sensitivity training that we're engaged with, we bring in outside subject matter experts to talk to our police officers about things like that. I mean, we just had a history of Baltimore of the LGBT community, and we brought in some folks from that community, and their unique perspective on their experiences with law enforcement gives us pause and makes us think about the way we interact with people.
Very quickly, I'm trying to get to this call here in 2 minutes we have left. I just got retweeted in the Lawrence's tweet was actually about you going to Annapolis about expungement as opposed to the other bill. That was my mistake.
Yeah, I have not testified in Annapolis about expungement. Certainly not opposed to it. I certainly would rely on my legislative liaisons to brief me fully on all aspects of any change to that. But listen, generally, I'm as reasonable as they come. If your case is dismissed or otherwise not prosecuted, then I think it's an absolute reasonable expectation that you shouldn't have to go looking over your shoulder for the rest of your life waiting to get snatched up on a warrant for a case that was dismissed. I get it. I think that's something that we can all agree on. It's just how do we make it happen? Just like the warrant forgiveness conversation. Okay, generally, on principle, I agree. But how do we address each and every aspect of that to make it feasible?
Let me get one quick call in here before we end the hour here with Commissioner Davis, 410-319-8888. Ernest, you're on the air. We have a minute and a half left, so very quickly.
Yeah. The quick version is everybody should see the Netflix documentary on tasers, killing them softly, how many people that was killed. And one thing that stuck out, I saw in this documentary, a 17-year-old white male.
All right, we're almost out of time, Ernest. So
Was tasered to death in front of his mother and father. So, when Bats brought up tasers, I told you it was going to be a problem with tasers. Bats denied that. Gave false information on tasers.
All right, Ernest, no thanks. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'll say this, Ernest. I recognize the taser policy in Baltimore need to be changed, and I changed it. And I'm telling you, I'm going to change it again. And it's a tool that I want cops to have, but I only want them to have it if it's used responsibly. And I'm committed to that. I really am.
So Commissioner Davis, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Look forward to having you back soon.
You tell me when.
All right. We'll make that happen. Thanks for coming in. And folks, thanks for all your calls and tweeting in. Tried to get to everybody I could. Didn't even get to all of my questions, but we will next time. And we'll take a short break, come right back. When we come back, we'll be looking at a local roundtable talking about these and many of the issues. Stay with us. We'll be right back.